The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bryan, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Bryan presiding. The first case this morning is A22-0173, Otter Tail County Department of Land and Resource versus Mark DeRuiter, James Edward Justin, Bruce P. Krause, Don C. Johnson, FN Mortgage, and Rebecca Church.
Good morning and welcome to this remote argument. I want to thank you all for being willing to participate in our remote arguments this morning. And I do have a couple of introductory comments just to make sure things run smoothly. First off, you should be able to see the clock. And if it's really small, sometimes you have to toggle between the gallery view and the active speaker view to see the clock. But before we begin, I want to make sure you can see it so that you know how much time is remaining. I also want to make a comment about interruptions. Now, we all understand that from time to time those things occur, doorbells, pets, that sort of thing. We'll do our best to keep it to a minimum, but we do understand that there are some, from time to time, some problems, and we will accommodate that to make sure you get all the time to which you're entitled. So if for some reason you can't hear us or somebody freezes, let us know as soon as you can, and we'll make sure that you're able to participate fully. I also want to mention that we are making an audio recording of the proceeding today, and that is the only recording that's permitted. And then finally, before you begin, if you would make sure we know how to pronounce your name and that of your client, and also if you would like, you can let us know how we can refer to you and your client during the argument this morning. And with that being said, are the attorneys prepared to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, attorney for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Gerald Boncorff for the appellant, Deborah Church. This is an appeal from the district court's order denying the joint motion brought by Otter Tail County, the plaintiff, and Deborah Church to vacate a 2011 enforcement order obtained by the plaintiff, Otter Tail County. Effective July 21, 2021, the order barred James Justin and his assigns from using the Justin property's lake access easement to both East Battle and Stewart Lakes. Deborah Church, our client, acquired the Justin Lake home in September 2020, and her deed carried forward Justin's Lake access easements to both lots 1 and 25. At the time of Church's purchase in 2020, both lots 1 and 25 were being used lawfully for lake access by defendants Johnson and DeRuiter based on the lot's grandfathered non-conforming use for lake access. In particular, the Johnson family, defendants also in the county suit, were still using their lake access easement.
Mr. Boncorff, if I can jump in, I know that the three of us are well-versed in the facts of the case and in the district court's order before them, and I want to make sure that you were able to maximize your time before us this morning, so I might move you along, so to speak. Can you show where in the briefs there is any argument asserting error in the denial of the motion to substitute? So I was trying to find the notice of appeal challenges that order as well as the ultimate decision, but I'm wondering where the argument is in the brief regarding the substitution of Church as a party in this matter.
Well, we have said that she has a standing because she is the addressee of the injunction. That is, she is the order is being applied to her by its own terms, and it's inconceivable that an order that specifically imposes enforcement on church cannot be attacked or responded to when the county attorney and the county itself says that the order can't be enforced against her.
So is that the, I'm sorry, is that the argument that the district court either abused its discretion or made an error of law in not substituting Ms. Church as a, or adding her as a party or substituting her as a party?
I think that the court's foundation for not substituting her in a party was the denial of the motion. In other words, I think the court treated this not as a question of county's enforcement, but really looked at this as if De Ruyter had a judgment against Justin and his assigns, and that Church was trying to vacate that judgment. And she said that can't be done. But that's not what, that's the way she exercised her discretion. And then having decided that, it's really kind of moot as to whether she's got standing or not, because the judge addressed the substantive motion.
Well, if I can ask a kind of a follow-up, as I'm trying to start with this threshold question of who gets to be a party and when. It seems to me that the district court's order, at least in part, denying the substitution motion was based on the fact that the rule seems to contemplate somebody being substituted in while an action is pending. And the district court looked at what had happened and concluded that the initial lawsuit, quote, the initial lawsuit in these proceedings was resolved over 10 years ago. So where's the argument in the brief that is a misinterpretation of the substitution rule?
But this motion is brought by the county itself. The county is bringing this motion, and along it's the two are inseparable. But, and I recognize that that De Ruyter is trying to frame this as if Church is the only party, but this is a motion which the county.
I understand. I'm trying to figure out if there's a difference in the caption from 10 years ago to now, then there has to be some proper vehicle and mechanism by which Ms. Church is substituted in order for her to then challenge or make a motion to vacate. So I'm starting with that threshold question. And I guess the very pointed question is, are you arguing in the brief to this court that the district court erred as a matter of law in interpreting the rule regarding substitution of a party to be limited to while an action is pending? Is that an argument that you're making in the brief, or is that something that you're not addressing?
The difference between and it goes to the fact that this is not a money judgment, but this is an equitable order, and the equitable order.
Well, it sounds like you have an argument to us, and that's my next question, is what is the argument to us now? But my first question is it in the written brief? And if not, I just need to know that, and then I'll let you give us your reasoning as to why the district court might have misinterpreted the rule. But where in the written brief are you making that argument, if at all?
I honestly, I think we've viewed what the court did as deciding her right to be here based on the substance of whether the motion can be vacated or not.
And can I turn you to that, Mr. Von Korff? Because I'm frankly confused about your arguments on appeal versus the arguments you advanced in the district court. As I read the arguments to the district court, the argument was that the 2011 judgment should be vacated because it's void. Void for two reasons. You contend that the district court lacked subject matter jurisdiction and you contend that the judgment was premised on what amounted to an unconstitutional taking. On appeal, I don't see any reference to Rule 60.02D, i.e. voidness as a ground for vacation. And in fact, the reference seems to be to a different provision of Rule 60. Is it fair to say that your arguments on appeal are different than the arguments you presented to the district court? So why should we consider them for the first time here?
There were two parties here, and the county joined in the motion, and they made the argument that this was an equitable order that they could not enforce. You have the county attorney saying the county's position is one that I don't understand in the 2011 order. I don't understand the position at the time and would disagree with it. She then says,
But Mr. Bonkorf, you don't represent the county, okay? And my understanding is you, on behalf of Ms. Church, did not advance the argument in the district court that you are proceeding with now. And again, my question is, why should we consider your alternative new arguments for the first time on appeal?
Well, the motion was jointly brought, and the county, in the joint motion, said, you understand, we wouldn't have brought this motion in the way we brought it if it weren't for the fact that Church went to the county attorney and said, hey, Johnson is using this easement. It's exactly the same as mine. And you're not enforcing it against them. Are you going to enforce this against me or not? And the county said, no, and agreed to vacate the judgment because it was a future enforcement judgment, and in the joint motion made the argument and told the judge that we can't enforce this judgment because it's unbelievable. We had no basis for bringing it in the first place. We don't enforce this order against anyone. We're not enforcing it against Johnson. We're not enforcing it against DeReuter. And what are we supposed to do with an order that we can't enforce? So if you want to say that we didn't make that argument because the county made it in the joint motion, okay. But there were two issues going on. One was the argument that the county did not obtain and the court did not obtain jurisdiction to get rid of the easement itself. Rather, the only issue was the county's enforcement of the ordinance and the county...
But as I understand it, Mr. Bonkorf, I mean, these arguments sort of go to the wisdom and whether there was error in the 2011 judgment, but that's not really the point on a motion to vacate, is it? I mean, the motion to vacate under Rule 60 has to be premised on one of several enumerated grounds. And so I'm still struggling to understand your argument now as to how the district court erred in considering the motion to vacate.
The order is not just a money judgment. It's a judgment that goes on in perpetuity that implicates the county's enforcement powers. And the county has said to the parties, we can't enforce this order. And the judge didn't address that. We're left... And this is the problem with an equitable order that the county can't and won't enforce. The The other arguments that are made in the brief, maybe if I could address that, one is the argument that counsel says that that the case is moot, and the case is clearly not moot. The county asked that it not have to enforce this order, that it could vacate it. That issue still stands. The De Ruyter has said that this is a collateral attack on the judgment. It's not clearly not a collateral attack on the judgment. It's the county and church both asking the that the order be vacated. Finally, in looking at this case, we've tried to find another case where something like this has happened. And it really is an animal of a different breed. In this case, a private party used the county's authority to drive Church off, Justin off a property, and then proceeded to use that property in the same way. And I just don't know that anything like this has ever been done before. And the county attorney looked at this and said, we can't allow the county's enforcement power to be used in this way. And yes, it's been a struggle to figure out what framework this fits in, but I think the county attorney made the right decision, and the judgment should be reversed.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Van Korp. Mr. Russell.
Honors. My name is Robert Russell, and I represent Mark and Ruth De Ruyter.
Mr. Russell, I'm going to stop you right there because I'm having already some difficulty hearing you. So maybe if you could move closer to the microphone. Sometimes when people turn their heads one way or the other or look up to make eye contact with us, the microphone on the computer is then too far away from their mouths or whatever. But if you could speak up, and then I'll stop you again if you need to, but go ahead.
I will attempt to do so, Your Honor. I want to, the arguments here are always shifting. And while I thought the basis of the new argument and appeal was the judgment in 2011 was final, now the argument is that the county was questioning its jurisdiction to enforce the order. And there's nothing in prior pleadings to that effect. It's Mr. Van Korf's surmise that that is what the county was doing. The county never filed a brief. The only briefs that were filed were one. Well, the county and Mr. Van Korf's client somehow stipulated to putting in Ms. Church as a party, and that requires a motion. And then they say there was lack of subject matter jurisdiction. And the county never argued it could not enforce the order. This is a pure speculation by Mr. Van Korf to give this court some basis to determine that a 2011 judgment that bound Mr. Justin should not be enforced against a party who had no privity with him and bought the property with a record, should have had record knowledge that this judgment existed. It's not a question of jurisdiction of the county. My client clearly has the right to enforce the judgment of the court that was entered in 2011, and it takes no action by the county to do so.
Mr. Russell, I'm going to jump in with the flip side of the same question that I asked Mr. Van Korf. Do you see these arguments as presented in the written brief to this court as only arguing standing, or do you see there being some argument regarding the interpretation of the rule or substituting a party?
Your Honor, quite frankly, I don't see that plaintiff ever addressed either. They somehow want to look over that fact by claiming the county was trying to avoid an enforcement action that they've never been asked to take. I'm not trying to avoid your question. I don't think it was ever argued by plaintiff. And they never argued at the lower level that the judgment wasn't final. They accepted that as a fact.
Mr. Russell, would it make a difference if the judgment wasn't final? How would that affect your argument? If we agreed with the notion that this judgment in 2011 was not final?
I respectfully don't think it would make a difference, but I think it's very clear that if it was final, you have to satisfy the reasonable time standard of Rule 60. I think the only difference would be that if it wasn't final, you wouldn't necessarily have a reasonable time standard under Rule 60, but you definitely have a reasonable time issue with it being a final judgment. And I would note that plaintiff never addressed on appeal the determination by the lower court that this matter was not brought within a reasonable time. So I think that's the only difference, but there's plenty of other reasons why, even if it wasn't final, that the judgment should be upheld. I'd like to move on. This notion that my clients had a controlled access that the county was trying to stop is the imagination of plaintiff's counsel. The actual amended complaint talks about the easements having created a controlled access. My clients did not have or need is easement over their own property. They had fee simple title to lot 25 of Nirvana, and as such, they had the right to use that property for the purposes consistent with the ordinance, and that would include.
So you're saying the ordinance back in 2008 or 2009, when the county brought the action, and the ordinance didn't operate against your client's interest in being able to access the lakes, correct?
Correct, because it wasn't an easement. If you adopt plaintiff's interpretation here, that somehow it acted. Controlled access also defined my client's fee simple ownership. That would mean under the current ordinance as amended in 2008, that everyone who has lake access because they're a fee simple owner has a controlled access. It's just an amazing affront to regular, normal interpretation of what happened here to have to address these arguments. This action was simply never intended to prohibit the owners of lots 1 and 25 of Nirvana from using their own land as lake access. As Judge Benson wrote in her order of December 21, docket number 44, page 15, Mr. Justin, as a result of his default, allowed the court to treat as established the allegation that easement was a prohibited non-conformity as of the time of its creation. Why should Miss Church, who didn't buy from Mr. Justin, who bought 2 years after he died, who had, there was a record to judge it, why should she be able to argue something that Mr. Justin clearly could not? She should not be afforded greater rights than Mr. Justin would have had at this late date to challenge the 2011 judgment. I hope I'm not being overly dramatic when I say the proposition that Rebecca Church should be substituted as a party and has standing to challenge the 2011 judgment should cause trepidation in any judge that has ever entered a judgment in a civil matter. It's simply ridiculous. This church, without the county's holding, is figuratively naked before you. I'm not party taking an appeal and abandoning any argument, every argument, that she should be substituted for Mr. Justin. There is not, as Judge Brian questioned earlier, and there wasn't, in my opinion, respectfully, an answer to it. There is no argument in plaintiff's brief as to this church being substituted.
Mr. Russell, as I understand it, Mr. Von Korff, I think, is essentially arguing that he did not need to appeal that particular part of the judge's order because of the equitable nature of the action. Do you want to, I think that's the argument. Do you want to address that?
One, I don't think there's any basis for that. Two, the county did not join the appeal. And we've had, and I wanted to object to the speculation about what the county was trying to accomplish. And that's simply what it is, speculation. And why should the judgment of the county attorney in 2020 be relied upon over the judgment of the county attorney in 2008 when he said this is a controlled access, when Mr. Justin had the right to come into court and say it wasn't, he did not exercise that right and a judgment was entered. So there is no basis to excuse the question of substitution, particularly when the county has abandoned any effort to get the judgment vacated. It should be noted that the 2011 judgment, as I said earlier, does not, or infer, oh, you could from my comments, does not simply belong to the county. It impacted my clients. They did not pursue an effort to see that action to its conclusion, to get an immediate termination. They paid money to get one party to terminate an access over their property. Another party, who I'm not representing, also relied on that and gave up access over my client's property because Mr. Justin was being, his rights of an easement over that other party's rights land was being limited and then removed. I want to move on. I apologize. I also thought about trying to address the issue of mootness, but I want to move on to the question of sanctions. I believe, as I understand it, my time now includes our cross motion to overturn the court's decision on sanctions. It is respectfully submitted that Judge Benson abused her discretion in deciding not to award sanctions. It is my client's contention that the legal contentions made on behalf of his church have no objectively reasonable basis. Consequently, I would acknowledge that it appears the statute would limit the right to recover sanctions against Mr. Church's or Ms. Church's counsel. In her order of January of 2022, index number 56, Honorable Judge Benson wrote that the motion for substitution was not frivolous, acknowledging that she had not ruled on the question because the county joined in the original motion.
Can I just stop you, Mr. Russell? I mean, I we've all read that order. And, you know, the one thing that reading the order a second time indicated to me is that the district court considered carefully your factual and legal arguments with respect to the propriety of sanctions, and the district court rejected it. What is a principled basis on which this court could find abuse of discretion in that decision?
Well, I think because I believe the three rationale she put forward to denying sanctions were not appropriate. I was just going to move into that. She did state that the absence of a Minnesota case that squarely addresses the propriety of making a Rule 25 motion as part of a 60 motion made it a question of first impression. I agree, I couldn't find a case, but that's just because case law makes it clear that a Rule 25 motion has to be made while the case is proceeding. So there should not be any cases addressing whether a party can be substituted to challenge a judgment that is final and no longer appealable. I would submit that if it is a question of first impression, it is so only because it is so absurd. It is just part of plaintiff's counsel's rabbit hole. And then she talked about that the proceedings up to the order were generally confusing. But remember, the motion brought here was to substitute and lack a subject matter jurisdiction. They have completely abandoned both of those. And whether or not you can try to figure out what happened before the judgment, it's clear if the motion is subject matter jurisdiction and standing, what happened with the judgment is determinative. You don't need to go back and say, well, I found something that didn't totally make sense to me 12 years ago, so now I'm going to say there's a basis for bringing this lawsuit. The record shows that, and she also said that the mootness issue did not lead to a conclusion that the claims were baseless, since it was an affirmative defense that was not so clear-cut to counsel as might be a statute of limitation defense. Yet the record shows that Mrs. Church acquired the property that she claims was benefited by the easement over lot 25 by a deed dated September 28, 2020. And the record also shows that in October 2020, a death certificate was recorded showing James Dustin died on October 3, 2018. Since 1959, Minnesota law has provided that a non-conforming use is discontinued for a period of more than 1 year. Any subsequent use has to be non-conforming, I should say. That's 1959 Minnesota Session Laws, Chapter 559, Section 16, codified at Statute 394.36. I think it is fair to say that any counsel looking into the merits of trying to open the 2011 judgment would have attempted to find out when the easement was last used, at least asking their client what he or she knew in that regard, anticipating a problem if there had been more than a few months lapse of time.
What did the record show with respect to Justin and his descendants' use of the easement over lot one? Because as I understand it, Justin had an easement over both of those lots.
Right. I have
any record evidence about lot one?
I have not focused on Johnson's situation, I must admit. I don't recall the record saying anything about the use of lot one. And so I'm not going to try to lead you to believe it might be there. I don't think it's there. I just want on that mootness point, it would have made sense for any counsel when they knew of record that James Justin had died on October 3rd, 2018, and Mrs. Church didn't acquire the property until 2020, to worry about the statutory and ordinance requirement that if a non-conforming use disappears for more than a year, it can no longer be used. I'm out of time, and I appreciate the opportunity to make my comments.
Thank you, Mr. Russell. Mr. Vanquist, rebuttal. Mr. Vanquist, you're still on mute, so you have to undo that, and then we can hear your rebuttal argument. Go ahead.
With respect to the argument that the county attorney did not say or advocate that the order could not be enforced, I just think that's completely contrary to what the record shows and what how this case came about. Ms. Church bought the property. She looked around and saw the easements and the property being used in the way that the order seemed to challenge. She had counsel go to the county attorney and say, what's your position on enforcement? And they said, on the record, our interpretation of the ordinance and the way we've enforced this ordinance all across the county is we cannot enforce this order. We want it, we agree that it should be vacated. And she says, the county attorney says on the record, and you know.
But Mr. Von Korff, what difference does that make? I understand the record shows that the county and your client agreed that this judgment should be vacated. But that was the court's decision. And so that puts us back into what are we reviewing? We're not reviewing whether the county wanted it vacated or not. We know they did. But whether the district court erred by failing to do so, isn't that the issue before us?
And exactly. And our view is that the court treated this like it was a money judgment instead of a government coming and saying, we don't want to enforce this judgment because we can't.
And why is that legally significant? I think that's really the question. Why is that particular, what's the legal significance of that?
Because of the separation of powers in which the court does not regulate the county's judgment as to whether an equitable order should be enforced. This happens more commonly in integration cases, in antitrust cases, and the district court did not respect or the county's statement that, hey, something happened here under our watch that was inequitable. And we cannot, and again, if you look at the, you know, council says, well, it's only easements that to which this controlled access applied, but that's not the county's position and wasn't the county's position. And besides, the Johnson family that is sitting there using the same easement that church received, the last thing in the world we want to do is to put the county in a position, and the county doesn't want to be in this position, where the meaning of this case is that Johnson's sitting on a controlled access that's not grandfathered, but that's where this case is going. And the county is trying to say, respect our interpretation. And the county attorney points out that the land office is being run by somebody with loads of experience, and he looks at this and he can't understand how this order came about, and they do not want to enforce it. And enforcement, if the county has a $100,000 judgment, you know, that's a different kind of judgment when the county has obtained a judgment that is equitable and lasts forever. And the courts can't force the county to enforce an order that's against county policy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Von Korff. I want to thank you both for your arguments this morning and your written submissions. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory timeframe. Have a nice day.